Now the mantras that I am going to sing are from two Upanishads mainly, the Isha Upanishad and Kathopanishad. The first mantra is the Shanti mantra or the invocatory mantra. It is normally recited in a study class, in a group where serious students meet together to study. It's both the teacher and the pupils recite this mantra together. What does it say? I am just giving you a very general translation of these mantras. The first mantra says, let the pupil and the pupils and the teachers say together, let the wisdom protect us both. Let it nourish us both. Let our intelligence be illumined. Let us work together, study together for wisdom. And the last of all, the most important thing, let there be a perfect harmony between us. Om, peace, peace, peace. The second mantra is a very well-known mantra which says, from the unreal, lead me to the real, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. The third mantra is about the wholeness, the whole. The word used in Upanishad is Purna. It describes the Purna or the whole in a very beautiful way. Then the mantra comes which says that this entire universe is the abode of Brahman, the ultimate reality. And therefore, wherever you are, you can experience it. You don't have to go anywhere else. And then the mantra says that the experience of Atma, the soul, or the Brahman cannot be had through the reading of books, through listening to lectures, through all the processes of the mind or the intellect. But there has to be the inner awakening. One has to rise above. And if one can do that beyond the mind, beyond the intellect, then it is possible to experience the Brahman or the Atman. I have given you in a very brief manner the general meaning of about four or five mantras that I shall sing.
Asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrutyo Oh.
the subject of discussion today has been put down as the way of the Upanishads. And I will examine this subject in two parts. First, what is the way of the Upanishads? And second, which we shall have in the afternoon, how can one tread this way? We must examine the philosophical implication of this subject, but also its practical relevance. Because it is not enough just to know as to what is the way of the Upanishads. We must find out whether the Upanishads have indicated anywhere as to how this way can be trodden. In other words, the relevance of the Upanishads, both philosophically and intellectually, and its relevance in terms of one's practical life. The word Upanishad has a very significant meaning. It means, literally it means, sitting near. Upa is near, and Nishada means sitting. Sitting near, that is the meaning of the Upanishad. You will see there is no religious bias, there is no denominational description. It just says sitting near the master, sitting near the teacher. That is all that the Upanishad means. And you will find as you study Upanishads, and there are many, there are 11 major Upanishads, but there are more than 100 minor Upanishads. We will not be concerned with the minor Upanishads, but we will just have a look, because that is all that we can do. We will just have a look at some of the major Upanishads. And in these major Upanishads you will find, as you will find in most of the Hindu scriptural texts, that the method that has been adopted is the method of dialogue and discussion. Nowhere does the teacher lay down the law. The teacher and the pupil, they discuss in the climate of complete intellectual freedom. For example, there is one of the major Upanishads which is known as the Prashnopanishad. That is the very title of that Upanishad. That is the Upanishad which deals with questions. There were six young people who wanted to know an answer with regard to some questions which were worrying them. They were not able to find any satisfactory explanation so far as those questions were concerned. And so these six young men started. They said, if we find a teacher, we will place our questions before the teacher. Fortunately, they found a teacher. And they said to the teacher, sir, we have certain fundamental questions which we would like to discuss with you. Can we place those questions before you? And the teacher said, no, not just now. He said, you must qualify yourself to put questions. It's a very strange statement. To qualify oneself to receive answers, one can understand. But this teacher said, you must qualify yourself to put questions. Because by and large, our questions arise from a very superficial level. We may ask the teacher, please explain to us what is God. And before the teacher answers, perhaps the questioner has already gone to sleep. And therefore, the teacher said, your questions must arise from a deeper level and not from a superficial level. And therefore, he said, remain in my ashram for 1 year. After 1 year, you still have those questions. Then bring them to me. But when you bring them to me, please understand. If I know the answers, I will give you the answers. But if I do not know the answers, then you and I together will go out in search of the answer to these questions. This was the intellectual honesty of the teachers of the Upanishads. Perfect freedom. The teacher not saying that I know the answers, but the teacher saying that if I know, I will place those answers. But if I do not know, we will inquire into the meaning and the significance of those questions. Thus there is a climate of complete intellectual freedom so far as the Upanishads are concerned. As I said, there are 11 major Upanishads. If you study the whole structure of Hinduism, although Hinduism is nowhere described as a religion, nowhere, neither in the Upanishads nor in the Bhagavad Gita, you will find the word Hindu. Because Hinduism is really known as the Sanatana Dharma. That means a timeless religion. A religion that does not belong to a particular time, but it is something that is timeless, something that is eternal. That is the name of what is otherwise known as Hindu religion. In the whole structure of this thought, which we know historically as the Hindu thought, in this whole structure, there are certain main divisions, main parts. One is known as the Shruti. It is a Sanskrit word, but it means direct understanding, direct experience. That is what is called Shruti. There is the other division which is known as Smriti, that which is remembered, not directly known, but that which is remembered. And it is in the Smritis that there are given certain rules of conduct, of behavior, of social pattern. And as they change, because they can't be permanent, the Smritis also change. While the Shruti is eternal, unchanging, timeless, Smriti belongs to time. Then there are other divisions also. One is known as the Itihasa, which means history. It is in history that we come across the two great books of the Hindus, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. Then come the Puranas. The Puranas are Hindu mythology, and there are various Puranas, number of them, which discuss the mythology of the Hindus, the mythological stories. Just as you find mythology in all religions, there is the Christian mythology, there is the Buddhist mythology. In Puranas, we find this Hindu mythology. Then come another set of literature, which is known as the literature of the sutras, the aphorisms. For example, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, Narada Bhakti Sutra, and there are various such sutras or aphorisms. You do not find such literature anywhere in the world, because this is the shortest description, shortest explanation of the profoundest of truths, that is this literature of the sutras. Then come the last, although there are many others, but I will not go into them, the last of the sections, which are known as the tantras. Tantra really means a technique, but there is a vast tantra literature of the Hindus, of the Buddhists, and of the Jains, because Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain, these are the main philosophical streams of India, and you find this vast literature of the tantra. But we will not go into all these. As I said, we will just have a look at the main teaching of the Upanishads. We can't go much into the detail, because each Upanishad will require much exploration. But we shall just have a brief look at some of the salient features so far as the teachings of the Upanishads are concerned. Dora Kunz, in the beginning, referred to yoga, because yoga is a system which has been developed throughout the ages in India. And yoga is fundamentally a scheme of psychology. the depth psychology of the Hindus or the Buddhists or the Jains can be described as the yoga psychology. And there are many, many books on yoga, profound books on yoga, apart from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. There are many, many books of yoga. There is the simplest book on yoga, which is the Bhagavad Gita. But in the Upanishads, particularly in the Kathopanishad, there is one of the profoundest definitions of yoga, which you do not find in any of the literature of yoga, vast as it is. Profound description and definition of yoga that is given in the Kathopanishad, where the young man, whose name is Nachiketa, is putting question after questions to the Lord of Death. And when the Lord of Death says to Nachiketa, the young man, inquire into yoga, that the young man says, sir, what is yoga? What do you mean by yoga? And there you find a very brief but profound definition of yoga that is given in the Kathopanishad. Yogo hi prabhava apyayav. He says yoga is both life and death. Not life and death separately, but life and death together. And he says it is only as you understand life and death together. Death as a part of life, life as a part of death. It is only when you understand life and death together that you have the understanding of yoga. This is a profound definition. We will not have time to go much into it, but I am just referring to it because this is something which needs very deep reflection of life and death together. But we shall go into the question, after all, what is the way of the Upanishads? What is the way that is suggested by the Upanishads? Because even though there are many Upanishads, these Upanishads have one subject. Whether you take this or the other or any of the 11 Upanishads, there is only one subject. The subject is the ultimate reality and the soul of the individual. And the Upanishads have made one of the boldest statements in the history of philosophy throughout the world. Because the Upanishad says that the nature of God resides in man. Nature of divinity resides in man. That between man and the divine there is no unbridgeable gulf at all. Because the nature resides in man. And because it resides in man, it is possible for man to rise to the stature of the divine. This is really the basic statement so far as the Upanishads are concerned. But let us see what is the way that the Upanishads have shown and whether that way has any relevance at all in this modern civilization of science and technology. We have grown up in the course of the last 300 years and more under an intellectual heritage that was given to start with by the European philosopher Descartes and later on became the philosophical basis of modern physical science. This approach that was given by Descartes is known as the Cartesian approach, the approach of dividing anything with which one is confronted into two opposites, to split up every experience into two opposites, and to try to understand that phenomenon by splitting up into opposites. This is what modern science has followed. This is our intellectual heritage, because whether we recognize or not, our thinking is based on this. We divide everything into two opposites. And we know one in opposition to the other. We know one in relation to the other. As Bertrand Russell says in one of his books, that in the ultimate analysis, all knowledge of the human mind is a relational knowledge. We know everything in relation. We do not know anything absolutely. The mind is unable to know anything absolutely. The mind knows a thing in opposition to the other. This is our usual approach at understanding. It is the understanding through the process of duality. Our thinking is dual thinking. In fact, wherever the mind enters, there is the phenomenon of duality. And the duality is naturally in conflict with each other. And therefore we see this conflict of duality at every level. Now the Upanishads have pronounced a statement that an understanding of life, of universe, of man is possible only when one approaches it from a non-dual standpoint. Non-dualism is the fundamental philosophy of the Upanishads. The way of the Upanishads is the way of non-duality. What is known in the Sanskrit language as the Advaita, the non-dual. This is, in nutshell, the basis of all the Upanishads, all the major Upanishads about which I have talked. But we approach everything from the standpoint of duality. We have to live in the world of duality. You can't deny it. After all, duality is this manifested universe. We live in it. But as we live in this dual world, there is always a conflict. Because duality represents contradiction. In duality, there is the opposition of one with the other. This is the normal functioning of duality. But the Upanishads say that these dualities can be transformed into polarities. The dualities are in conflict. The polarities are not in conflict. The polarities, they are the complementaries. Today in modern physics, some of the scientific thinkers have been talking of the complementariness. Because physics itself has seen the dual aspect of the universe. Whether you call it a wave, or you call it a particle, or you call it by any other name, there is this duality that is seen. And the scientists, so far, and that is what Capra says in his book, The Tao of Physics, that the scientists so far were concerned as to what to choose. Is light a wave phenomenon? Or is light a particle phenomenon? And he says this is the initial mistake of the scientist, that we are not to make any choice whatsoever, because today some of the scientific thinkers tell us that what we call light is both wave and particle together. The wave is the particle, and the particle is the wave. Now, wave is a phenomenon of continuity, obviously. Particle is a phenomenon of discontinuity. Continuity and discontinuity existing together. This is what the human intellect cannot understand. Because the human intellect can say, yes, it can be continuous, later on it can be discontinuous. In other words, we can understand two things in succession, but two things simultaneous, that is something which the human intellect is not able to understand. Now the Upanishads have talked about the transformation of duality into polarity, so that that which is in contradiction is regarded as something complementary. We know that light and shade in a small area are contradictory. They can't exist together because one negates the other. But if you look at a landscape, then in the landscape, light and shade not only exist together, but their existence together gives an enrichment to the beauty of the landscape itself. Two contradictory things at one place are no longer contradictory at another place. They become complementary. In other words, that which is contradictory is transformed into contrary. Two contrary things can exist together, but two contradictory things cannot exist together, because they would negate each other. And the Upanishads have said that although the world of manifestation is a world of duality, there is no reason that there should be conflict and contradiction between the two. There is a possibility, if one treads that path, there is a possibility of transforming that which is contradictory into that which is contrary, that which is contradictory into that which is complementary. This is the approach of the Upanishads. And you will see that it has a great relevance, because this is with which we are struggling today in modern science. Because while modern science says, for example, Heisenberg says, can nature be behaving in such an absurd manner? Two contradictory things existing together. Can nature be behaving in this absurd manner? And he says, nature always replies to us in the language of paradox. And the more we persist in our inquiry, the sharper becomes the paradox of nature. In other words, nature speaks, or life speaks, call it by whatever name you like. Life speaks to us only in terms of paradox. And the paradox is two apparently contradictory things existing together. This is what life presents us with. This is what we see in nature. But how can these two things exist together? Scientists, scientific thinkers, they say, we have noticed it. But we cannot understand how such a thing can exist at all. This is because we have a limitation of perception. Our consciousness is a conditioned consciousness. It has a particular scale of perception. And that particular scale of perception is a successive scale. In other words, consciousness, because that is the basic fact. Science also tells us today that it is not matter which is the basic fact. It is consciousness that is the basic fact. But the scientists are trying to understand what is that nature of consciousness which can understand two things simultaneously and not successively. In other words, is there a state of consciousness which does not function in limitations of time, because time means a succession, that there is a state of consciousness which functions not in the succession of time, but it functions completely differently. And this is what is known as not a successive consciousness, but a simultaneous consciousness. And the Upanishads have spoken about this consciousness, which is a simultaneous consciousness. We speak these days of a holistic approach, the approach of wholeness. The Upanishads have ages ago spoken about this holistic approach, because it says it is only in terms of the wholeness that you can understand the mysterious phenomenon of life. But the wholeness about which the Upanishads speak is not totality. Totality should not be identified with wholeness, because totality is the sum of the parts. But the wholeness is greater than the sum of the parts. It transcends the sum of the parts. This is once again a mysterious statement. What is it that cannot be put in the totality? If it is there, then surely we must be able to put it in totality. For example, David Bohm, in his book, The Wholeness and the Implicate Order, says to us that the whole is mysteriously greater than the sum of the parts. And the Upanishads have spoken about that wholeness, not about totality. Totality one can understand. Mathematically we can come to the totality of experience. But this whole experience is something which cannot be found by any process of totality, by no computerization. We may have the most excellent of the computers. Computer can give us totality at best, but computer cannot give us wholeness. And the Upanishads have spoken about this wholeness. This is another aspect so far as the philosophy of the Upanishads is concerned. One of the great Indian mystics, Kabir, I'm sure some of you are familiar with that name, his 100 poems have been translated in English by no lesser person than poet Rabindranath Tagore, the 100 poems of Kabir. In one of the poems, Kabir says, "Behold the unity, behold the oneness of all things." And then he says, "It is the second that will lead you astray. Behold the oneness of things, but it is the second which will lead you astray." In the Upanishads, there is a story. And the Upanishads has many stories, many significant stories. In the Upanishads, there is a story. It is said that the original man, he one day found that he was afraid of something. Fear grew in his heart. And he said, "What am I afraid of? Why am I afraid? So far I was never afraid, I never knew what fear was. Why am I afraid? I'm afraid because I'm alone. Because I'm alone, I'm afraid." But on further reflection, he said, "If I'm alone, of what am I afraid? If I'm alone, of what am I afraid? Because fear is not something in abstraction. Fear can be with regard to something. And if I'm alone, how can I be afraid?" And therefore he said, "No, it is not because I'm alone, but because of some other reason." And there you find the profound short statement of the Upanishads, where the Upanishad says, "Dvitiya dvai bhayam bhavati." The Upanishad says, it is duality which is the begetter of fear. When there is second, then as the Kabir says, it is the second that leads me astray. The Upanishad says, it is the second, the moment there comes into existence the second, the duality, then fear is bound to arise. And mind is all the time the creator of duality. The mind cannot function without duality. If you give one point to the mind must create its opposite. And then it can move between the two points. But if you do not give the two points, then the mind feels frustrated. No thinking process is possible if the two points are not there. And therefore, in the very functioning of the mind, the duality comes into existence. Where there is no mind, this duality does not come into operation at all. And therefore, there can be no solution to the problem of fear in the compass of mind itself. In the campus of mind, there is no solution whatsoever to the problem of fear, because mind is itself the creator of fear. And therefore, if one wants to get away from the suffocating atmosphere of fear, one must go not analyzing the mind, but one must be able to go beyond the mind, because it is only there that the problem of fear can be solved. In fact, it is very, very difficult to find out whether the Upanishads speak of philosophy or they speak of psychology. Because in the ancient traditions of India, there has been no distinction between philosophy and psychology. Philosophy is the vision. The psychology is the translating of that vision into one's practical life. And therefore, philosophy and psychology have never been divorced. It is true that in Western tradition also, philosophy and psychology started together. But later on, psychology separated itself from philosophy. But in the Indian tradition, philosophy and psychology have remained together. We had in recent times a very brilliant philosopher in India by the name Sri Aurobindo. And Sri Aurobindo speaks about psychology in his book entitled The Synthesis of Yoga. In that book, Sri Aurobindo says at one place This is the statement. I am quoting exactly the words of Sri Aurobindo. He says therein that the significance of the lotus cannot be found by analyzing the mud in which it grows. The significance of the lotus cannot be found by analyzing the mud in which it grows. And what is it that we are doing today? We are analyzing the mud. And from the analysis of the mud, we want to find out the significance of the lotus. It cannot be found. This was the basis of the Upanishadic psychology or the Upanishadic philosophy, that the significance of life, significance of man, is not in the mud in which it grows. It is true that lotus grows in the mud. It's a beautiful lotus. But the significance, the meaning is not there. The significance and the meaning is somewhere else. And this is what the Upanishad tries to point out, what that something else is. It is some transcendental factor which is the cause of this. In other words, there is some sort of a link between the unmanifest and the manifest, between the transcendental and the immanent. And it is because of that link between the transcendental and the immanent that there comes into existence this mysterious phenomenon that we call lotus. The same is the case with regard to man. We cannot understand man. If we want to understand man through the analysis of that which has been manifested, through the analysis of manifestation, we cannot understand what man is, because it is not in this analysis. There is something that is unmanifest, and it is only when the link between the unmanifest and the manifest is understood that we will be able to find the meaning and significance of human life. And the Upanishads speak about this mysterious link between the unmanifest and the manifest. Or, to use modern scientific term, the link between the explicate order and the implicate order. As David Bohm says, that the meaning of the explicate order, the manifested universe, is not in manifestation. The meaning can be found only in the implicate order. Why? Because manifestation at any time is incomplete. It is partial. It is the unmanifest that is the whole. If we want to understand the wholeness, then we must find out what is the intimation of the unmanifest into the manifest. Because it is only in that intimation that one can have the perception of the whole, not in the manifest. The meaning of manifest is not in manifestation. The meaning of manifest is in the unmanifest. And the Upanishads have spoken about it. In Upanishad after Upanishad, we find this wholeness explained to us.